Ave Maria Stella, Dei Mater Alma.
Welcome everybody to another edition of Census Fidelium Hour. This is your host Steve Cunningham of censusfidelium.com. By the way, check out censusfidelium.com every day for your updated sermons of the day, saint of the days, etc. I update it every morning. Sometimes I don't get to it, but maybe 9 o'clock or 10 o'clock, so don't sue me. But every day you'll have the saint and sermons of the day, especially during Lent and post-Lent, and pretty much all the way up to Pentecost. I'll have something every day for the liturgical day and, of course, the saint of the days. And after that, it's going to be saint of the days between the weeks of Pentecost up to Advent. Advent, every day of the week. Lent, every day of the week. Weeks leading up to Advent, the Septuagesima season. For those not in the traditional rite, it's the 2.5 weeks prior to Ash Wednesday, every day of the week. So, and then when I get to those, when it's just saints, I'll put something else that are random ones for. But anyways, check it out. I have more content there than you will see on forum by far. Anyways, we're in the week 2 of Lent. Welcome. If you haven't gone, you're 1 week down, 5 to go. Keep your heads up. Keep pounding away, as we say in the Carolinas, right? Try to crank it up just a little bit more. Somebody was shocked that I told him, because they asked me in the confessional, what are you doing for your penance? I said, well, I'm fasting every day. They were like, wow, you're fasting every day? You know, that's what we used to do. If you're not doing it every day, give it a shot. Maybe add one more day. Maybe last week you didn't do any days except for, and maybe you did Ash Wednesday, you didn't do anything last week. Well, this week try one or two. Next week try three. The next week try four. When you get to Passion Tide, which is Passion Week, Palm Sunday, all the way up to Good Friday, and Holy Week, especially Holy Week, try to do 5 or 6. Try to do every day. You know what the Catholics of old did? They cranked it up big time. Maybe just bread. Not telling you just to go on a hunger strike. Do what you can to your physical limits, but push yourself, just like in sports. I guarantee there's somebody out there that's a sports person out there that wants to get better at this, that, and the other thing. And you don't do it by doing the minimal thing. When I played basketball, I practiced hours, 6 hours a day, shot till I made 500 3-point shots, 5 from each position behind the arc, and that's not including inside the arc, and that's not including free throws, and that's not including the drills I did prior to that, and that's not including the layup drills and things of that nature, and ball handling. I got on a baseball team and didn't play baseball for 8 years prior to getting on the college baseball team, just because I worked my tail off to get to that level to be able to get on the team. That was my goal, just to get on. After that, we'll figure it out afterwards. But that was to get on. The coach never saw me even pick it up until I went there and for a little tryout. And that was it. No high school. Played one season of JV high school. That was it. Played basketball the rest of the time. Got on a Division II baseball team. Why? Because I worked my tail off on it. And I carry that over into this. Work your tail off, just like St. Paul says. Run the race, the finish. Because what's the goal? Heaven. I'm pretty sure heaven is a little bit tougher to get on than getting on a baseball team, or at least more worth it, I guess you could say. Actually, it's kind of easy to do, as one priest says. It's easy to do. It's just hard to do. As St. Paul says it, I do the things I don't want to do, and I do the things I don't want to do, and I don't do the things I need to do. And he mentions about how it's hard. He drives himself and trains his body and chastises it for fear that that what he preaches to others, he himself will be disqualified. We got to have that mindset. Anyway, so what I'm doing today is a priest I followed. All right. One of the fruits, if you want to say fruits, of the bad, traditionalist custodes came down through Pope Francis, killed a lot of the traditional movement in a sense. Didn't kill the movement, but killed a lot of momentum, most of the momentum out there. And what it did here in the diocese, unfortunately, was restrict some of the sacraments and the pre-55 liturgies that a lot of the parishes were starting to turn to. And that's not just here. It went into a lot of other parishes. So one of the things, I wasn't going to go to the 1962 Bugnini Mass, traditional one. I know those society guys, yeah, they do the Bugnini. They might trash on Bugnini. They love Bugnini. They can quote. They can go ahead and take this clip and put it out of context, whatever they want. They still do the Bugnini tritium. Don't let them fool you. It's okay when they do it. So anyways, what they one of the things about it is it made us check out the Byzantine. Because I told one priest, I ain't going over to society. Ain't no way. Till they come back in under the bishop, you ain't going to catch my tail. You ain't going to catch my shadow crossing over that threshold. I'm too much in the obedience of the bishop for that. So I went to the Byzantine. They're in union with Rome. If anybody's thinking, what? No. Yeah, they are. The Eastern Rites, St. Basil's went to. Because Father goes, we're pre-4th century. And so I would, by the way, it's beautiful. If you haven't been, go. Especially to the Tritium. It was a wow. I was so jacked because you read Garinger, you're reading about what the liturgy is. And you talk about the reverence of the cross during it on Good Friday. And how Garinger writes about the veneration of the cross is the lady get down on the ground, on their knees, to venerate the cross. And he calls it the people's communion because during Good Friday, nobody receives communion. I don't know if I don't know if the Novus Ordo does that or not. I haven't been in quite some time. Last time I went, I was pretty much wanting to take the flute player. It was in Spartanburg, South Carolina, and I wanted to crush the flute over top of the head like Animal House, if anybody's remembering that. That was the last time I went to a new rite tritium. So I've been going to traditional rite ever since. And so one of the things they venerate the shroud, and you're on your knees walking up to the shroud on your knees. I thought that was the coolest thing, especially because when you think about the veneration of the cross, that used to, in Garinger writes that they did that because it used to be the true cross that you reverenced. And each parish after that had a replica of the true cross. So spiritually, what you're venerating during that Good Friday is the true cross. That's why it's the people's communion, because you're supposed to venerate the true cross, and whatever the cross is there, that's taken the place of the true cross that they venerate in Rome. But they didn't have the true cross, was not found till St. Helena did later on, when the Byzantine rite, the Eastern rite, the rite of St. Basil, St. John Chrysostom was put together. So they had the shroud. So you venerate the shroud, and I'm watching this going, that makes sense. They haven't found the cross yet. So you're venerating the shroud. It is everything they do is just fantastic. So anyway, check it out. But one of the things it did was I went through all that and kept going every Sunday. Still go. We've been almost every Sunday that they've had it. Because it's just, one, it's a little bit earlier for the kids because, you know, most of the trad masses are later. Not too great for families. You're in the middle of lunchtime for the kids. Kids need their naps. It drives them batty. So instead of having to wrestle with the kids the whole time, we've gone there where it's a little bit earlier. We get the kids home, take them a nap, all that jazz. Great. Works out great. And so where was I going with it? It made me think about other, you know, what other parishes are out there? So I found three other parishes that put their sermons up, and they've been fantastic stuff. So if you go to the Sense Fidelium YouTube channel, you will see their sermon. And here, like I said, just dynamite. One of them was this priest I'm about to present to you, Father Abernathy. He used to be at the St. Philip Neri Oratory in Pennsylvania, and is now at one of the, he crossed over to the Eastern Rite, united to Rome, with the Byzantine parish up there. And he's been putting podcasts out for quite some time. He's got the whole Conferences of St. John Cassian on there. If you don't know Cassian, if you know the Benedictines, they use Cassian for creating the rule. Benedict used Cassian. St. John Climacus is going on currently right now. The Ladder of Divine Ascent. One of the best books ever written. You want to be a saint? Get that book. He's doing a Lectio Divinae, basically, style on St. John Climacus. Just brutally fantastic. And he's got other ones. St. Isaac the Syrian's homilies and the introduction to Philokalia, about 10 different ones for that one. Back in the day, he did that one, his original ones. And the other day, he did one on the love of fasting. There's a book, it's out of print, And I sent it to a couple publishers to go, hey, man, you guys got to check this out. This is a book that's right here. It's if you go on Amazon, it's $400 because there's three left in the world, I think. And so hopefully somebody will republish it. It's in the public domain. It is a PDF format. I might send it to a third guy here in a little bit. Anyways. So anyway, he did a podcast. Came out a couple weeks ago. I missed it because I was taking, of all things, fasting. I took the kids to get pizza. VIP pizza in Gastonia. Fantastic pizza, by the way. And kid, my oldest, who will turn five tomorrow. He'll turn five today when this is airing on St. Thomas's, in the old traditional calendar, St. Thomas's feast day. He ate three or four pizzas. Kid's 50 pounds. We've been serving him raw milk for over a year now. It's been great for him. Yeah, that's another story. Anyways, I was late getting back to the party, and I was like, I'm not going to be able to watch this. It's halfway done. No, Father went on for 2 hours on this topic. So what I'm going to do, I'm going to play the audio from that lecture. And I know I went the intro for this particular video. I wasn't going to go for longer than 2 minutes, but I got a little carried away. So I'm going to start playing it on the next segment of the episode. It's The Love of Fasting. I think the subtitle is The Monastic Experience. And you read about that. Again, that book of Joy of Lent. The Benedictines talk about joy, joy, joy all the time. The joy of fasting. You can have a joy of fasting. Even though it's painful for your innards, it can be a joyful thing. You look forward to it. You can make it joyful by saying, this is my way of spiritual combat. To corral your passions. To get your anger under control. To get your lustful thoughts under control. To get all these passions that can be uncontrolled, can be outraged, and as they say, untamed horses running wild, to get them under control, to be able to say no to a little piece of whatever, food or such. Because if you can't say no to the little things, how are you going to say no to the bigger things? So we'll get that on the flip side.
Hi, everyone. I'm Dr. John Acquaviva, host of Faith and Sport here on Carolina Catholic Radio. Our show addresses the aspects of sport, character, morality, and ethics often neglected in everyday sports conversations. For instance, we discuss the morality of transgender athletes, some diocese's decision to disallow practice or games on Sundays, and the poor habit of injecting politics into the game. But first, I want to thank you for listening to our network of shows, and in particular, our show, Faith and Sport. The Carolina Catholic Media staff works very hard to bring you important and updated content directly related to our wonderful faith. And considering Carolina Catholic Media is fully funded by the listener, we need your financial help to keep bringing this programming to you. So please offer a monthly pledge or one-time donation to keep us moving in the right direction. And join me, Dr. John Acquaviva, as I discuss my two favorite topics, my faith and the world of sport, on the Faith and Sport Show here on Carolina Catholic Media Network. And we look forward to your donation.
Hi, everyone. It's Jason Murphy for the Catholic Men's Conference of the Carolinas and the Obligation Radio Show here on the Carolina Catholic Media Network. Registration is now open for the 13th annual Catholic Men's Conference of the Carolinas to be held on March 18th, 2023 at St. Thomas Aquinas Catholic Church. It's going to be an amazing day of faith, fellowship, and prayer. Of course, we'll be joined, as always, by our own Bishop Peter Jugas of the Diocese of Charlotte. We also have a great lineup of speakers, including Charles Frawney. Charles is the author of Slaying Dragons, What Exorcists See and What We Should Know. He's going to be there to discuss spiritual warfare. Also joining us, Jonathan Fanning. He is an author, speaker, an entrepreneur, and a father. Coming to us from High Point, North Carolina, the Diocese of Charlotte, is Deacon John Clark. Deacon is a former NYPD SWAT officer and former MMA fighter. You won't want to miss this one. Scott Wieman is going to be another one of our speakers. He is with Catholic in Recovery. He's going to talk to us about addiction and recovery for Catholics. And our MC this year will be Kevin Spaulding. Kevin is a speaker, an author, and business life coach. You can go online now to www.catholicmenofthecarolinas.org. Make sure to use the promo code radio and save $5. We look forward to seeing you there on this awesome day full of faith, fellowship, and prayer. For the Catholic Men's Conference, Carolinas, the Obligation Radio Show, my name is Jason Murphy. God bless, and esto vir.
Welcome back. It's Steve with the Sense of Fidelium Hour. Steve Cunningham with the SenseofFidelium.com and the YouTube channel. Anyway, also check out SpiritusTV.com because they just added movies on there too. Anyway, let's get right to the program. I've stopped my yapping. We're going to get into Father David Abernathy. That's him right there. So I'm going to have his face up and get my ugly mug off the screen if you're watching on YouTube. And here we go.
Glory to Jesus Christ. Glory forever. Welcome, everybody, to Philokalia Ministries and to our discussion of fasting this evening.
By the way, if you go through the Philokalia, I got the website up. It's philokaliaministries.com, and you can see it's a podcast. We'll just type in Dr. Father Abernathy, and you'll find his podcast.
Under the topic, To Love Fasting. And this is was an unexpected group for Philokalia Ministries. We typically have a group on Monday and Wednesday on the Everett Latinos and the Ladder of Divine Ascent. And about 3 weeks ago, I did this group for the college students at the University of Pittsburgh and Carnegie Mellon, and was asked if I would be willing to offer it to a wider group and also to have it recorded, that it seemed to spark a pretty strong interest. And even here in the last couple of days, a lot of people seem to contact me about it. And maybe just to give a little bit of a history as we get started and as people continue to join, I first started reading about this about 35 years ago. And I came across an article by a Benedictine monk named Adalbert de Vogue, V-O-G-U-E. And he had written an article under this title, To Love Fasting. And the title itself captured my imagination because I'd never heard somebody speak of fasting in those terms before, that often it has a kind of negative connotation tied to it as being something difficult, especially during the holy seasons, difficult to maintain for a prolonged period of time. The experience of it is often seen as being unpleasant, especially when beginning. People struggle with fatigue or headaches or irritability. And sometimes in the course of, say, the season of Lent, someone will attempt fasting of some sort and find themselves breaking away from it after a period of a week or so, not able to maintain it. And so to come across this article, To Love Fasting, made me want to read more about it, that I had been new to the Catholic faith about 40, I've been Catholic for about 40 years now. So I was in the faith for about 3 years prior to reading this and was a novice of a religious community. And I made a little mistake at the time. I was so taken with the article that I photocopied it and put it in everybody's mailbox in my community, thinking this is great. What a wonderful article. But that was a big mistake, I found out. It was taken as kind of inherent criticism, I think, or a suggestion that we should all be fasting in the way that the author suggested. And that wasn't the intent, of course. I think, again, I was enamored with what he was saying and how he described it, even in this brief article. Later on, a book came out in 1989 under the same title, where he describes the history of fasting and the practice of fasting, even the physiological changes that take place or the challenges that one might face in the practice, and then what he describes as the fasting that we see emerge very early on in monasticism among the Desert Fathers, that opened up a kind of vision for him about the practice of fasting and its importance for the spiritual life. I think most of us have probably heard many homilies from the fathers about the tie between prayer and fasting in particular, or that prayer without fasting is weak. But we might rarely hear it spoken about in homilies or talked about in groups or a specific plan or a rule of life that puts it forward as something that would be a regular part of our spiritual life, that we would see it as something essential, something beautiful, and something that deepens our prayer as well as helps us in the struggle with the passions. And so something ultimately that we would come to love, and how we would come to love that, love such a thing, is part of what I want to discuss with you here this evening. My plan is to have this be rather informal. You know, I'll pause every now and again and open it up for questions or comments. You can feel free to write them in the chat section as we're going along. Sometimes that speeds up the process in terms of my responding. Or if you're uncomfortable with that, you can just open up your mic and ask the question directly. So I've already mentioned the words to love fasting are intriguing, and they're not my words. They actually come to us from the role of Saint Benedict. And I mentioned in some of my previous groups that I had a professor in seminary. I studied at a Benedictine seminary in La Trobe, St. Vincent's, and he did his doctoral dissertation on joy in the role of Saint Benedict. And as he studied the role, he found out that Benedict uses the word joy most of all in his writings about Lent and the season of Lent, with the deepening of the disciplines that they would embrace as monks, including fasting. They also experienced a greater joy as these practices were something not simply to be endured, but that would draw them into a greater intimacy with God. And so the fruit of this greater discipline was not hardship, but rather a joyful intimacy with God. And so around the same time that I was exposed to this article. And Benedict uses the words jejunium amare in the section on tools for good works. So to love fasting is one of the specific tools for good works. And I think often when we think of works, we think of external practices of charity, which of course is true. But for the monastic tradition, and in the monastic tradition, especially among the Desert Fathers, the interior life or works have to do with the struggle with the passions, and ordering our desires and appetites towards God and the things of God. And so tools for good works, under this title, Benedict would have this in mind. What is it that we embrace, and how do we embrace the certain disciplines in the monastic life that open us up in a greater way to God, that helps us to love him in deeper measure, as well as love our brothers in community, to be able to be vulnerable before them, to be able to endure perhaps insult or neglect or hardship in one way or another, but to enjoy it in the spirit of joy, the joy of Christ. And so when we look at this, though, and we turn our minds and our hearts to sacred scripture, is where I would want to begin, I think we have this sense of fasting being a part of Christian asceticism, as I mentioned, and part of the spiritual life. But what De Vogue captures for us is not only the connection with prayer, but with almsgiving as well. Peter Chrysologus, in his homily that's part of the Office of Readings for Ash Wednesday, speaks of this three-footed stool, if you will, of prayer, fasting, and almsgiving, which are a part of our spiritual practices during this time. And so prayer, fasting not only deepens one's prayer life and creates a hunger and desire within oneself for God, but also by eating less, the monasteries had the capacity to give a greater amount of food to the poor in the area and the cities that would be nearby their monasteries. And so it allowed them to give greater alms because they were not spending as much or needing to have as many meals throughout the day, but also as many parts of those meals through the day. So they were saving a great deal of money and resources in the deeper fasting that they had embraced. And so Lent is referred to as a joyful season. And if you're a Latin Rite Christian, you've probably already become familiar with this in one of the Eucharistic prefaces during the Mass that describes Lent in specifically this way, as a joyful season. And yet it's hard to wrap our minds around this when it is tied to self-deprivation of not eating or satisfying a fundamental appetite that we have as human beings, and that our appetite for food. And so, as I mentioned, it's often tied to a kind of affliction spiritually for us, or has this kind of odious connotation to it. And I think this has been changing over the last 20 or 30 years. And it was interesting. One of my earliest experiences with this was back in high school, where I was an athlete, and I remember reading some magazines about weightlifting. That was certainly part of my training. And I read that a lot of these weightlifters would fast a few times during the week to, as it were, purify their system. They would say, drink only juice during the course of the day. And I remember being intrigued by that and even practicing that on occasion as a way of trying to remain fit, but also to embrace some of what they had experienced. But I think in more modern times, we are beginning to make a greater connection between the role of the body and the mind.
So I'll finish this on the next segment. Well, not finish. We'll continue with this in the next segment.
On January 31st, 2019, Carolina Catholic Media signed on Charlotte's first Catholic radio station, AM 1270 WCGC. By the grace of God, we celebrate the past 4 years and look forward to continuing our apostolic vision and mission to serve the Carolina Catholic community. We are evangelistic partners with our clergy, active parishioners, the fallen away, and the homebound. We are accessible to all Christians, agnostics, and atheists. With distribution of a wide array of content across 7 media platforms, there truly is something for everyone. During these past 4 years, Carolina Catholic has expanded to 7 media platforms that include radio, internet stream, mobile app, website, YouTube, social media, and e-newsletter. Nearly all local programs are available by podcast and video on demand. In the year ahead, we're committed to promote more local parish, school, and ministry events, more live broadcasts, and more valuable content that showcases our dynamic local Carolina Catholic community. Of all the Catholic radio stations in the U.S., Carolina Catholic is arguably a leader in locally produced programs. To continue our work, Carolina Catholic Media needs $15,000 in monthly funding to continue operations across our 7 media platforms. We are 100% dependent on your generosity. If you love what we're doing, please join us with a monthly tithe or annual gift. We have partnership plans available for parishes, schools, and ministries. If you own a business, you can be a program sponsor on one or all of our platforms. You can do a live broadcast of a special event, with promotion before and rebroadcast after. On behalf of everyone at Carolina Catholic Media, we thank you for your past support and look forward to you joining us with the resources the apostolate needs to continue to evangelize the truth of Jesus Christ and our Catholic faith across the Carolinas. May God bless you and your family abundantly.
Everybody, Steve with Sense Fidelium Hour. Let's get right back to Father David Abernathy on the love fasting.
That these two are interconnected for us as human beings. And what we experience with one element of who we are also has an effect upon, for example, our emotional life, or, you know, the kinds of thoughts that we are having. So I think across the board, we find more discussion about that, of this unity between flesh and the spirit, if you will. And so it can refine, I think, the way that we think about things, our awareness of what's going on internally for us. As we become more aware of how we feel physically, we often become more aware of how we are feeling emotionally. but also of the kinds of thoughts that we might be having and how we are using our time. We just simply become more self-aware. It deepens, I think, our self-consciousness through the practice. And so in our day, we find people embracing fasting for all different kinds of reasons and for health reasons. We talked in some of the groups about intermittent fasting, that people are embracing it as a way to lose weight that they had discovered by eating only during a certain number of hours during the day and fasting during the rest, that, that physiologically things begin to change for them and they begin to shed weight rather quickly. And so even just on a secular level or on the level of health, we see some subtle changes beginning to take place. And also within the spiritual realm, among Christians, and I've seen this among Catholic Christian men and women, is the practice of something called Exodus 90. Have any of you heard of this before? It's a practice of engaging in a spiritual discipline for 90 days. So preceding Lent, almost what we would do within the Eastern Church with meat fare and cheese fare, where we gradually begin to deepen our fast and abstinence. And as was true also in the Latin Rite in earlier times, where one would begin to prepare oneself spiritually for the upcoming holy season in a similar fashion. But what I've seen emerge is this practice of Exodus 90 that involves a whole host of spiritual disciplines, cold showers, sleeping on the floor, no television, no use of technology. It's very rigorous and very demanding. And but what I found to be curious over time is that I'll hear individuals say, oh, yes, I did that once and it was great. And so you get the sense that it was a kind of test of endurance and a very rigorous test at that. Getting up every morning and taking a cold shower, I'm sure, was not a great thrill to all these guys. And women have started something similar. I can't quite remember the name of it off the top of my head. But it sort of drew or gave rise to a question for me. If it is something positive, and if there were definite fruits experienced through it, why would it only be done episodically, or maybe even only once, even by those who are putting it forward and advertising it as being a good and powerful thing on a spiritual level? When we look at things across the world, we see fasting done for a whole host of reasons, sometimes as political protest. We remember Gandhi is probably one of the most famous examples of this, who would undergo fast or would eat nothing at all in the face of violence within his own country and to bring an end to it. And so often it is seen as a kind of instrument of political protest. Or solidarity, I think, with those in the third world, with those who go to bed hungry every night and who lack the things that we have available to us and take for granted. And if you've ever talked to somebody who comes from a third world country and goes into one of our grocery stores, it's almost a kind of shock that they go into when they see the sheer abundance of food that is accessible for us. And when they would often have to go without eating for days on end. And so to show a kind of solidarity in one way or another, either through the practice itself, or then also to tie that to a kind of almsgiving or giving to charity or offering one's time and going to poor places to serve the poor. And medically, we also know that it's used to treat people that are overfed. And so over the course of the last 30, 40 years, one diet fad after another to limit caloric intake or to change the way that people were eating, to, as a cure for anything from insomnia to headaches to schizophrenia. That fasting was embraced for all of these different reasons. And part of it is the idea was to cleanse the body of its impurities or to change our metabolism. And in doing that, we can alter one's mental state. And there is truth to that. And I think that's something to keep in our mind. It's not our goal. But sometimes it can alter one's interior state and bring a kind of state of peace of mind to a person. One's brain chemistry can change in and through it. And so the motivation for fasting over the course of the years has been broad and very deep. And when we begin to look at scripture and look at it from a Judeo-Christian perspective, we see some of the specific reasons for it. But maybe before we jump into that, does anybody have any comment about the specific practices that I mentioned or anything that comes to mind? Or any experience of something like Exodus 90 that you would want to talk about? For women, it's called Fiat 90. Thank you.
Yes, Father. I've been doing it. I don't take the cold showers. And so I limit some of that. I haven't been doing the exercise as much, but I've been focused on the fasting and got very excited when I saw your link. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think, you know, the Isaiah 58 comes mm-hmm. into mind. Mm-hmm. So if it's a Wednesday or Friday, I attempt not to watch any news or TV and try to deplug, not just food fasting, but from anything electronic. And it's somewhat difficult because I teach, but nevertheless, I limit that. But I met some students who were doing Fiat 90. That's how I got its name for women.
Okay, very good. Thank you. And yes, you know, across the board, I think people have described it as something that they experienced as fruitful. But where does it lie within the Christian tradition and within the spiritual tradition of the church as a whole? And that's what I would hope to get to here this evening, and how we move from an episodic practice of it, or tied to various things such as political protest or solidarity or health reasons, to tying it more specifically to Christ himself. And this is what I think De Vogue does in an extraordinary fashion for us. When we look at scripture and fasting in the Old Testament, there are a number of different reasons, repentance often being the key reason for one's sins, and specific holidays in particular. For example, the Torah requires fasting simply for one day at Yom Kippur, and Rosh Hashanah, so the last 10 days leading up to Yom Kippur would be tied to the experience of Moses being up on the mountain prior to bringing down the second set of tablets of the law. And there had been this disobedience, as we know, a golden calf is made, and Moses destroys the first set of tablets. And so this holiday is tied to this experience and the penance that is tied to it as well, this disobedience to God. And but it was limited and currently limited to one day of practice, very strict, no eating, but simply for the one day. Later Jewish tradition added 4 days to commemorate the events that led up to the destruction of the temple in Jerusalem, that in the year 70 AD, much as what our Lord had foretold, the city was burnt to the ground and many perished in the process. And so in commemoration of this event, 4 days of fasting are embraced in memory of it. Samuel and the Israelites fasted as they put away their false gods of Baal and Ashtaroth, and return to Yahweh. And so in 1 Samuel, we see fasting, again, taken up as a penitential practice because one had turned away, or a group of people had turned away from God to the false gods of the country that they perhaps happened to be in. And this happens especially during the time of the exile, when basically so many were forced to intermingle in other cultures and eventually would marry, but also take up the practices of the religion of a particular culture. And so turning away from these false gods often would be tied to the practice of fasting as well.
Carolina Catholic Media News. The 13th Annual Catholic Men's Conference of the Carolinas will be held on Saturday, March 18th at St. Thomas Aquinas Catholic Church in Charlotte. Key queries: who are you looking for? This Catholic Men's Conference was formed in 2010 with the objective of bringing Catholic men together throughout the Carolinas for a day of fellowship, faith, and sacraments, to challenge each participant to grow their Catholic faith, deepen their relationship with Christ, and live up to their callings of Catholic men, husbands, and fathers. The day begins with registration at 7:30 a.m. with a full program of outstanding speakers, Mass, lunch, rosary, and adoration. For details and registration, visit CatholicMenOfTheCarolinas.org. General admission, $40. For the Carolina Catholic Media News, I'm Pam Cullen. God bless y'all.
Teachers that care, professors that care about you. Just an awesome experience all around.
There's peace here. There's encouragement here.
Faculty, everybody that works here, they really set you up for success.
I don't think I have ever felt as loved and as supported and as encouraged as I have at the Abbey.
There's something here that's underlying and intrinsic. It's like a spirit of love and community. And I think the spirit is God's presence here.
Belmont Abbey College, a world away, but close to home. Visit us at belmontabbeycollege.edu.
Faith and charity are key elements of life, but are they at the center of your retirement planning and life insurance decisions? Knights of Columbus, a trusted organization with a proud history of more than 140 years of helping its members, can help Catholic families with insurance and retirement planning solutions. Most importantly, we do this in a way that is compatible with Catholic teaching and the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops Investment Guidelines. Today, we have expanded our offerings to include retirement annuities, long-term care insurance, and disability income insurance. Beyond the benefits of financial protection, members may take satisfaction in knowing that Knights of Columbus contributes to causes that align with Catholic moral teaching. Let your faith inspire your financial decisions. Terms and conditions apply. Learn more by calling Field Agent Bob Gordon at 516-551-7838.
Hey, welcome everybody to the Sons of Fidelium Hour. I cut myself off in the last one, so the last segment's coming up. We'll finish. That's a two-hour thing, so if you want to watch, want to listen to it, the MP3, it's at the Philokalia Ministries. It's the website is philokalia.com, I think is the correct website. Let me check it out. philokalia.podbean.com. So yes, that's the official site, and it has all kinds of topics on there as well, and they're again fantastic to listen to. So here's Father Abernathy to finish out this segment, or for finish out the show.
It was also part, and this was interesting, part of the Israelite preparation for battle, that one would fast, as we see in the book of Judges 20 and Chronicles 20, as well, that prior to going into battle and as a way of seeking God's strength and help in that battle and victory, that fasting would be taken up for this purpose. Daniel, and so if you look at Daniel 9, in particular 9:3, fast as he prays to God to grant him the ability to understand the scriptures. So he's tying his fasting, praying for greater illumination, that God would open his mind and his heart to the word, that he might understand it with a kind of clarity. You all remember the story of the city of Nineveh, of course, where Jonah passes through the city foretelling its destruction. And so the king has everyone in the city, including the animals covered with sackcloth and ashes, and they all fast. And the disaster, as it were, as the calamity that was to come upon all of them was averted through the practice, through the conversion of heart. So all of this involves a kind of humbling of oneself before God, and sometimes of entire communities of people. So not necessarily an isolated practice, but very much like for all of us during the season of Lent, something that a whole group of people would embrace together as a way of turning toward God and away from evil or sin, and seeking God's grace or strength for one reason or another. And so I know that's just a cursory view of the Old Testament, but no, we're limited in time. Just wanted to give you a little bit of a sense of how it was practiced. And I think this was mostly my understanding of fasting, was seeing it as penitential and tied specifically to one's sin. And certainly that's true. And I think when we understand that our passions are often rooted in our appetites and our desires, and the fact that they are so often disordered and directed simply towards satisfying ourselves rather than seeking the will of God, we can understand why fasting would be taken up then, not only as penance for our sin, but as a way of bringing order to our appetites. And so when we begin to look at the New Testament, one of the things that steps forward first for us, especially during Lent, is the fast of Christ himself, that he identifies himself in a radical way in his humanity with sinners. And so we first see him as he comes out of his ministry, standing in line with them in the River Jordan to be baptized with John's baptism of repentance, despite being sinless himself. And his preparation for the beginning of this ministry was being driven by the Spirit into the desert for 40 days. So at this point, the Spirit descends upon him, and we're told in the Gospels that this very Spirit drives him out in the desert to fast for 40 days and there to do battle with the evil one. And I think this is an important thing for us to comprehend, that we aren't fasting simply in accord with our own will or our own judgment or for ourselves, but as a response in particular to God and to his Spirit of love drawing us to himself, or preparing us to embrace his will in our life. And so in imitation of Christ, we take up this practice, and in particular these 40 days, to struggle again with our own sins, with our own passions, but to open our minds and our hearts in a greater way to embrace the gospel in our lives. So it's a time of deep self-reflection for us to see how we are living our lives, whether it's in accord with the Gospels, with the Beatitudes, whether we love God with our mind, heart, soul, and strength, and our neighbor as ourselves. And so it's a way that we are enabled to be guided more fully and deeply by the Spirit of truth. And in some of the groups, you might remember me describing humility as truthful living. Michael Casey, who's a Trappist, defines it in this way. And I've often found it to be intriguing as well, that part of our fasting involves a humbling of the body that then also humbles the mind and allows us to see with a greater clarity what's going on interiorly, where our appetites are found or where they're disordered, where they direct us. In the humbling of the mind and body, when we find ourselves, especially towards the end of the fast, we often find ourselves more aware of what's going on in those thoughts or where we struggle. Our main passion, perhaps, that we struggle with often begins to manifest itself with a greater clarity to us. And so this is a good starting point for us in our reflection upon fasting, to look directly to Christ, as is true with all of our practices in the spiritual life, that Christ is the standard for us, the model for us. And so we see him in his desire to be ever faithful to the Father's will, to embrace his humanity in all of its fullness, to experience its poverty, including our hunger, and to experience it in all of its fullness, and there also to do battle with Satan himself. And we know the first of those temptations that he experiences is because of his deep hunger in coming out of the 40-day fast. You know, why embrace the weakness of this human flesh? Cast off it, change the stones miraculously into bread, feed yourself. Why put yourself through this? Manifest your true identity and dignity as Son of God. And I just want to make a little digression here, because I think it'll help us ultimately to understand why we see Christ do what he does, that we see in these temptations in the desert, Christ undergoes something similar to what we see in Adam and Eve, that our temptations are typically directed towards our passions and our appetites, or what we struggle through, concupiscence, a weakness of our will and a darkness of intellect. We often don't see things clearly, and so take the wrong path, or even when we do see them things clearly, we don't embrace it. Our will directs us in a way that it's contrary to the will of God. But when we look at the temptation directed towards Adam and Eve, it's towards their self-identity. And when we listen very closely to what the serpent says to them, take, eat of the fruit of the tree, and your eyes will be open, and you will know good and evil for yourself, and you will become like gods. And they embrace the illusion that they would take for themselves the prerogative that belongs to God alone, this capacity to judge between good and evil, and they would have it for themselves. And we see how quickly, in stepping aside from the identity that God had given them and the blessings that he had given them, how quickly they who would be God suddenly could not even control their own passions and desires. They begin to hide themselves physically, clothe themselves in their nakedness, and they even seek to hide themselves from God as if that were a possibility. And so that communion, that constant communion that they had with him, was broken in this irreparable fashion. And we see the same kind of temptation directed towards Christ, that it wasn't directed towards a weak will or a darkened intellect, but rather, again, towards that self-identity, and this time in his embrace of our poverty, our humanity. And in each case, it's tempting Christ to take that same path, cast off the poverty of your human flesh, change the stones into bread, fill yourself. And then taking him up to the top of the temple, fling yourself down in this great sign. It's said that the angels will come to protect you. So manifest your identity to everyone. Cast off the flesh and its weakness. fling yourself down from the parapet of the temple, or finally seize by divine right what is yours alone as son of God. So take all the riches of this world for yourself. Again, take, let go of the poverty, this path of poverty that you've embraced for yourself, both in flesh, but also in terms of the experience of the weakness of that flesh within this world.
So anyways, again, this is just, you've listened to 33 minutes. There's another hour and a half to go. So if you want to go to it, again, philokalia.podbean.com. Just do a search in your website for Father David Abernathy, and you'll see it. He's got weeks of podcasts that are on there, and they are golden. Anyways, God love you. Have a great rest of the week. Happy Lent and a joyful Lent to you. Happy fasting.
Virgo, Felix.